Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today's show is all about looking back. We'll talk with a Michigan historian about what you might have found on the holiday dinner table more than 100 years ago. And the hosts of It's Just Politics, Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, will join us as we remember the year in Michigan politics. But first, it's safe to say 2012 was a pretty darn good year for the auto industry, especially if you compare it to, say 2009. Profits at the Detroit Three are up, the companies are adding jobs, and car sales are rising slowly but steadily. Today, we're joined by Michelle Krebs, who's senior analyst with Edmunds.com, and Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio's own Autobeat reporter. We're going to talk about some of the big auto stories from the past year. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
So let's start out with something that I think I've been hearing a lot of, I think we really have, and that's fuel efficiency. You know, it seems like car companies are building every new car to be more fuel efficient than the one that came before. And then this summer, we had the federal government finalize some strict new fuel economy standards, the CAFE standards. I want to start with you, Tracy. Just how strict are these new standards?
These are really strict, especially if you look at the end goal of 2025, when we're supposed to be getting 54.5 miles per gallon average.
That's average.
So it translates to more like 49.5 miles per gallon because they're going to give the car companies credit for more efficient air conditioning systems. But even so, it's more than double really what we have now on our average. So it's a real stretch.
Yeah, because we're averaging about 24 miles a gallon if we're lucky.
That's right.
Michelle, how do we get there or can we get there?
Well, we'll see because there is a review period in 2017, so we'll see if those are revised. Certainly electrification of vehicles, and when I say that, I don't mean just a pure electric car. I'm talking about plug-in hybrids, hybrids, better batteries. There will have to be some technological breakthroughs, and there will have to be some cost breakthroughs because that technology is very, very expensive and consumers have balked at spending money on it.
And that's why I call this the magic wand thinking. I mean, we hope there are those cost breakthroughs. We hope there are those technological breakthroughs. But if we don't get them to the extent where we can meet the goal, what do we do? Give up the goal? Or do we start talking seriously again about increasing the cost of gas? Because it's the simplest way to get people to buy more fuel-efficient cars. It's considered political suicide in this country at this point. Maybe it won't be quite so much by 2020, and we can see that we're not going to reach our goal. I don't know.
It's hard to envision that right now. And a gas tax has been talked about back in the Lee Iacocca days, and it's never happened. And wow, in this environment,
I'm a dreamer.
Guess you are. I can't see it happening.
And I do think the American car buying public really it really is a short memory when it comes to gas prices. And I just saw $3.05 yesterday. Wow. I mean, we were flirting with $4 not so long ago.
I would argue that I think that we are at a tipping point. Typically, what we see is when gas prices go way up, people buy small cars and hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as they come back down, people start buying SUVs and trucks. That has not happened this time. November, gas prices were pretty darn low, and people bought small cars in big quantities. That surprised us. So I think that there is a shift in thinking that people want fuel economy. Maybe it's because we've been through a recession and people are in tighter budgets, or they just don't want the volatility of gas prices in their household budget.
Do you think people have learned, gee, we can drive a car versus an SUV? Have we perhaps moved beyond
our... There's some of that,
but there's also the SUVs today aren't the same as they were. The Ford Explorer today is not the Ford Explorer.
Yeah, it's 25% more fuel efficient.
And what we're going to see is we've seen a lot of fuel efficiency in the small cars. Now we're seeing it mid-sized cars. It's moving to large cars. And there's a lot of work going on in the pickup truck category even.
Let's switch over. Something that we really heard a lot about was the auto bailout during the presidential race. The drumbeat sounded in the auto companies were saying, stay away, no photo ops. We don't want to be a part of all of this. We do not want to be the poster children. And we did actually have the CEOs of two of our Detroit Three issue statements to counter some of the claims being made of the campaign trail. Michelle, in your career, have you ever seen anything like that past campaign season?
I have never seen the auto industry so politicized, or a vehicle like the Chevrolet Volt being a poster child for political polarization. It's quite amazing.
I came into being the Autobeat reporter right before the bankruptcy. So I can't say that this seemed abnormal because bankruptcy seemed normal to me. But yeah, it was. And the claims that were being made were just so patently absurd in many cases.
On both sides.
Yeah.
Right? Or yeah, more but, one but side than the other?
I mean, Jeeps being shipped off to China for all Jeeps being constructed in China when just we were, you know, Chrysler's been making these big investments in the Toledo plant and that makes Jeeps and that kind of thing.
Yeah. The Obama administration, their campaign did make much of a headline that Mr. Romney never said. That was the big lie on their side, is that he never said, let Detroit go bankrupt. He actually argued for a structured bankruptcy, just like we had.
And I dare say, has ever a headline left more impact, a headline that he did not even write?
Right. It was written by the paper itself.
And I think we have to, as we talk about that, the fact that GM's going to be buying back 200 million government share. Talk a little about GM's recovery and the overall picture.
Well, I think that them buying back their stock and getting the government out of the business is a huge milestone in this journey. It closes that when it's all said and done, which is going to take some months, it'll close that chapter. It'll free GM to do more things. I've never been clear on how much that impacted consumers buying GM vehicles.
I think it impacted the folks in GM psychologically. When you talk to people sort of just off the record about what it means, they are so anxious to get rid of this nickname Government Motors and just be GM again. And to me, that's the main impact this is going to have.
And there are practical things. I mean, way more paperwork. They can't pay people more than the government says, which is difficult in terms of keeping people and recruiting people. So there are some nuts and bolts. But the consumer who won't go to a Chevy dealership because GM got a bailout, I think they're few and far between. I may be wrong, but I think that seems
me. I think if you look at how they recovered from the bankruptcy so quickly, you can make that argument that consumers really did not punish GM very much for
that. And I think the consumer is looking for a quality vehicle at a great value. It's simple.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we're looking back at 2012 in terms of the auto industry as we talk with Michelle Krebs. She's a senior analyst with Edmunds.com. And then Tracy Samilton is with us, Michigan Radio's Auto Beat reporter, talking about consumers going to showrooms and looking back at the year. Car sales and auto activity really has helped power America's economy, hasn't it, Michelle?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've seen that over the last couple of years. Consumer spending has been driven largely by, which is a big segment of the economy, has been driven by car sales. And nothing seems to, no matter what happens economically, car sales keep going on.
Yeah, there's just this continual slow release of all this pent-up demand. And it really is picking up the economy much more than I think it's being given credit for. Treasury, I think it was the first quarter of this year, said that the GDP growth we saw that quarter, half of it was due to auto sales and auto manufacturing. Half.
We have to spend some time talking about the Chevy Volt. You know, it became fodder for politicians, certainly, as we just talked about. But it really is an interesting, it's a groundbreaking car. And I understand you both got a chance to tool around in a Volt for a week. So you each have a Volt story. I want to start with yours, Tracy.
Okay, well, my story is how I took GM at their word that this is a car you can do anything in. So, you know, when you can drive for about 40 miles on battery and then it kicks over to a gas generator and you can drive for many, 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 many more miles on the gas. And the week they gave me the car, I was going on a camping trip in Pennsylvania. After 40 miles, you know, on the highway, it turned over and I couldn't really tell. And I drive, I fill up with gas like a regular car. And then I get to the campsite and it's this little dirt road. And then to get to my actual cabin, it looked like a 45-degree hill.
Ooh, up the hill.
I'm thinking, you know, if you count the R&D costs for this car I'm driving, it's probably $1 million car. And I'm like, I'm really going to do this. But, you know, GM says, do anything with this car that you would do with your normal car. So I drove it up, and there's my cabin, and it has electricity, and I plug it in. So I even have a photo of the Chevy Volt plugged into my rustic cabin. And, you know, for most of my trip, I drove it on the battery. And then coming back, I drove it mostly on gas. And that is exactly how it's intended to be used.
Very, very livable. What's your story, Michelle?
Well, it's short and sweet. I had the Chevy Volt, had it plugged into the plug in my garage. Mm-hmm. What I didn't realize is that same line is not a dedicated line for the garage. It's connected to my bathroom. And when I plugged in my hair dryer, poof.
Everything.
Blew a circuit. I'm told it wasn't the volt. It was the hairdryer that draws a lot of electricity.
That's pretty funny. So the moral of the story is if you're going to have that baby plugged in, just pay attention to where you plug in your hairdryer.
Exactly.
Let's talk about in the next few weeks. Anybody in the auto industry, certainly attention is going to be heading to the North American International Auto Show coming up. So what big news, Michelle, are you expecting to see?
Well, first of all, I think the mood will be very good because we'll be coming off a very good year and we're anticipating, if we get by all this fiscal cliff stuff, another really good year. And I think the theme, again, will be fuel efficiency for everything. But we'll see a lot of luxury cars. We're going to see sport utilities. It's all over the map.
So the funereal mood of, like, the 2010 auto show is
history.
Thankfully.
They may actually feed the media this year. Yeah.
There might be shrimp.
And what about you, Tracy? What are you looking forward to with the auto show?
Well, I guess Cadillac has an electric coupe.
It's called the ELR, and it's based on the Chevrolet Volt technology.
Yeah, so I think that'll be really interesting to see. And then poor Lincoln is going to be showing a crossover, and they haven't been getting very good reviews for their sedans. So let's hope this crossover does a little better for them. I'm hoping that people are enthusiastic about it.
We've been talking cars with Michelle Krebs, senior analyst with Edmunds.com, and Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio's AutoBeat reporter. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was great.
Still to come, we travel back more than a couple centuries as we learn about some of the winter holiday traditions and food we would have found in Michigan in the 17th or 18th centuries. This is Stateside, and we'll be right back. We turn now to farming in Detroit, fish farming. The city's planning commission recently approved a new urban agriculture ordinance, and now the city's one step closer to officially recognizing the dozens of urban farms and gardens scattered all across the city. The ordinance also defines the kinds of projects that would be allowed, such as farm stands, orchards, or greenhouses. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia reports some residents are experimenting with aquaponic systems, a method of growing crops and fish at the same time.
Over here is our chicken coop. We have about 42 chickens and 4 ducks so far. You can hear the ducks. They're awfully loud and hungry, probably.
That's Noah Link. He lives and works in the Boston Edison neighborhood in Detroit. I met up with him at a small farm he calls Food Field. It's on the site of what used to be an elementary school. Imagine a small 4-acre farm tucked away in the city.
So if you go a few blocks one way, there are huge historic mansions, and you go a few blocks the other way, and it's all run-down, old shops, and total poverty. And we're right in between.
Link and his business partner worked on several farms across the country, so they knew owning a farm wouldn't be easy. But they're doing the hard work. On the land are different kinds of crops, a few beehives, a young orchard of fruit and nut trees, some chickens. There's also a hoop house to grow vegetables year-round.
And we've just built an aquaponic system to be able to raise fish in there, which I'll show you.
An aquaponic system is a combination of hydroponics and aquaculture, growing plants in water and fish farming.
And it takes the best of both of those in a self-sustaining system. The plants grow out of the wastewater from the fish that just gets circulated with a pump, and they clean out the water to keep it safe for all the fish in the tank.
A lot of people who work with aquaponic systems grow tilapia. It's a fast-growing fish, but they're tropical, so they require warm water. So Link wants to raise bluegill and catfish. They can tolerate colder water.
Rather than spend potentially tens of thousands of dollars on a boiler to heat the water here, we're going to grow some more local fish.
But Link and others who've joined the urban agriculture movement in Detroit are kind of doing it under the radar.
It's not really illegal. The only thing that's illegal is keeping farm animals, and we're not changing that quite yet.
Catherine Lynch Underwood is a city planner with the City of Detroit. She helps create the new urban agriculture ordinance.
And really Detroit will, I think, be able to blossom and position itself as a global leader in how cities will feed themselves, as well as positioning ourselves to have impact on urban food systems.
Aquaponics is one of those systems. It's happening on large scales around the world and on a smaller scale here in Michigan. Jim Gill is with Aqua Growers, a commercial aquaponics farm in Livonia, just 20 miles west of Detroit. He gave me a tour of his operation in a simple warehouse.
I have lots of worries, see? You know, when I show up and whistle at them, it's time to eat. Same with these guys. And you can see how big these are. These are marketable already. Some of these are well over 2 pounds.
Gil grows tilapia and greens and sells them to local markets. He says an aquaponic system is a good alternative to traditional farming because you can do it almost anywhere.
As long as you've got just a small backyard, you can do this, or a small basement.
But it's not catching on as fast as he'd like it to.
You know, people are not embracing it quite as quickly because that's just not the way it's always been done. Well, we don't want to be everybody.
Gil says he's in the research and development stage, and he's teaching other people how to use the system. So remember Noah Link, the young urban farmer in Detroit? He wants to learn as much as he can about aquaponics. And there's one more thing. He wants to try to fill a void in Detroit, which often lacks access to fresh produce. He wants to change that with locally grown fish and vegetables.
Really, I'm interested in showing different kinds of farming models that other people can apply either in their gardens or on bigger scales, and just producing as much food as we can sustainably here in the city.
The new urban agriculture ordinance will go to the Detroit City Council and Mayor Dave Bing for consideration early next year. If it's approved, it could open the door for more fish farming in Detroit. For Stateside, I'm Mercedes Mejia.
You can see photos of the aquaponics system and the photos from Noah Link's farm. Just go to our webpage at michiganradio.org. And there's another group looking at the possibility of fish farming in Detroit. Recovery Park is the name of the project. They're hoping to revitalize the city and help people find work. Gary Wozniak is the president and CEO. He has big plans for Recovery Park, involving everything from growing tilapia to processing foods and establishing a 30-acre farm scattered throughout the city.
So the models that we're looking at are a combination of the community gardening that's happening in Detroit, the indoor agriculture that's being promoted by Michigan State University, and then a lot of the larger indoor models in Europe, predominantly in the Netherlands.
The new urban agriculture laws will certainly play a big role in making this redevelopment project a reality in Detroit. But it all started with a big idea, and with the help of Self-Help Addiction Rehabilitation, or SHARE. It's a Detroit-based substance abuse treatment program. SHARE's mission is to give individuals with addiction and people who are recovering a chance at a new life. And that project is very close to the heart of Wozniak.
So I'm a recovering addict. And when SHARE called, I graduated from SHARE's outpatient program in 1987. So it's an opportunity for me to give back aid to the recovering community. Because of my addiction, I also spent 3.5 years in federal prison. So I'm a returning citizen, so I also understand the impact of having a felony conviction and spending time in prison. And I'm a high-functioning guy, so college-educated, own my own businesses, access to money, great support network. Most people don't have those same abilities and talents and support. So being able to help other recovering people that are struggling achieve the kind of freedom that I have, and being able to pass that on to other people with mentoring is really, really important to me.
To find out more about Recovery Park, just head online, go to michiganradio.org. Tis the season for holiday parties, holiday lunches and goodies at the office, and of course, holiday dinners. As we plan out our upcoming holiday dinners, for Christmas, it's always turkey at my house, always has been. I guess it always will be. We decided to check in again with our resident historian, Bill Loomis, find out just what Christmas would have been like in the Michigan of days past. Bill, it's pretty well accepted Charles Dickens created that Victorian Christmas that we tend to think of as Christmas. But take us back to the earliest days of pioneers and settlers in Detroit and Michigan. Was there a Christmas celebration back in the 1600s?
They were doing a French Christmas in the 1701 up through 1820s, really. It was still basically a French town. So they did a meat pie at night. They had a celebration called Réveillon, which is still celebrated in Quebec and down in New Orleans.
Oh.
It went on during the night. There was no Christmas tree, of course. That came later with the Germans coming to Detroit. But they had a Yule log that they burned, and they would roast turkeys, wild turkeys, and sometimes geese or ducks suspended from a cord in the hearth, and they would turn and baste it as they went. They had meat pies that they were basically ground meat. It started out as pigeon pies. They're called touchers.
Hmm.
And, they really feasted well, and brandy for the men and cordials for the ladies, and it was quite a big deal.
And it was a good long feast. So would it be Christmas Day, night. Christmas Eve?
It was Christmas Eve. It went from the night. It started like around 1 a.m. Or it started when they came back from Mass.
Oh, so you do Christmas Eve Mass.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Do Christmas Eve Mass, and you come back and have this big feast that would go on until 8 a.m.
And then sleep it off on Christmas Day.
I think that's what they did. But they did have little gifts in the kids' shoes and stuff like that.
So the gifting and the feasting was right there in those early days.
Oh, yeah.
Then as we moved from being French to being the United States of America, part mm-hmm. of that, how did things evolve?
Actually, Christmas wasn't celebrated until about 1840, the earliest, because Protestants didn't recognize Christmas. That was Catholic. Because the people that came to Detroit were coming from New England once mm-hmm. the Erie Canal opened. And so from about 1820, mid-20s up through 1840s, there was a great emigration of New Englanders and from New York.
So that took till up to not too long before the Civil War then.
Right. It really was after the Civil War that Christmas came on strong in Detroit.
And was part of that because the whole country became enamored of Charles Dickens and A Christmas Carol?
You know, that's really true. And as I said, there were a lot of German immigrants that came over, and Christmas trees came with that. And a lot of the cooking, especially cookies and cakes, you'd start seeing more German Kuchen and things like that.
So we can thank the Germans for the bake fest that
yeah,
we all get into.
That's right. That's right.
So what might have been the typical Christmas feast in Detroit or in Michigan at that time? So we're talking like post-Civil War?
Yeah. Yeah, late 1840s up through Victorian days. They did a big Christmas Day feast, and they would do turkeys, but also geese. They would roast geese or poach geese. They did hams. A lot of times they would do goose pie. There was a famous Christmas goose pie that was made of goose meat along with smoked tongue. They mixed lots of meats together to improve the flavor. But
yeah,
I know.
Nothing says Christmas cheer like smoked tongue.
Yeah, exactly. But that was traditional. And they would also use, along with sage and thyme, they use cinnamon sometimes in flavoring meats. Clove was real popular.
Okay.
Mace, nutmeg, a lot of nutmeg.
That probably came from Europe, did it?
Yeah, it came from the colonies as well because the spices were quite common. You know, they were bringing spices over from the very early days. So they used lots of herbs and not so many herbs, but lots of spices and a lot of some dried herbs.
Because I can remember my first Christmas as a new bride. I married a man from Cork, Ireland, and we were back having Christmas dinner, and there was a turkey with potato stuffing, but there was a wonderful thing called spiced beef, and it was beef, and it had the cloves and the nutmeg and the cinnamon. Mm-hmm. Haven't had it then or since, but
maybe I'll make you one. I made one the other night, and it was a big hit. Yeah.
Wow. Yes. That was 1978, and I'm still dreaming about that spiced
that's
beef.
That's what food does to you.
Yes, it can indeed. Now, what about talk a little about the tree?
Well, Christmas trees back in the early days were pretty dangerous. I mean, they used open candles on Christmas trees.
Boy, oh boy.
Yeah, they fastened them on. They also had really dangerous ornaments. They had real popular were celluloid Christmas ornaments. These were invented. Celluloid was invented in the 1850s and brought to the States. And, celluloid film.
Yeah, I'm thinking of that next.
Even today, ping pong balls are made of celluloid.
Okay.
And if you're ever a kid and want to do something really stupid and dangerous,
you
lit those and they go up with obnoxious black smoke. So imagine your trees festooned with those babies along with open flames.
And drying out. I suppose they weren't as careful as we might be to keep it
watered.
And then
they used aniline dye was real popular. It made of real deep purple and deep blue colors. So they had ornaments. They used aniline dye, which is like, let's decorate the tree with gasoline this year. You know, it was really dangerous.
Yeah, boy.
And there was recorded instances over and over about Christmas tree fires. So people – and then they had gas, illuminating gas. They didn't have electric lights. They had what they called illuminating gas. So it was gas nozzles that came out from the wall. And it was real popular to drape evergreens and roping on these open gas things. And so when the kids came down for Christmas, the dad or mom would crank the gas way up for that Christmas experience.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with food writer Bill Loomis. We really call him our resident historian as we kind of dig into what Christmas meals and Christmas celebrations were like in the Michigan of days past. Bill, was there a great difference between the way things might have been done in the cities versus, let's say, up north?
Well, the cities had a much more diverse population. Mm-hmm. So by the 1890s, there were more people living in Detroit from overseas or that were born overseas. And so the celebrations were much more diverse, and there were more Catholics in Detroit than there were in the rest of Michigan.
Okay.
It was just cosmopolitan. So there were many more things to look at and see and do. It was a little more exciting, I would think.
I know. As a child, I lived for the Laura Ingalls Wilder little house books, but she did a mm-hmm. very detailed description mm-hmm. of Christmas in the little cabin
sure.
in the big woods in Wisconsin, which I suspect would probably
yep.
much like
yep. probably
like getting
much
an orange was a big, big deal.
I know. That's right. It was fairly modest, but mm-hmm. Much beloved. And they didn't, in the settlers' experiences, they went for long times without meat. They ate gravy mixed with meat fat. And if they caught something and they ate wild meat, that was common. But they would go without salt, without meat for long periods. So a holiday was a big deal if you brought out something special like turkey or a goose or something like that.
Or a peppermint stick.
Yeah.
I remember Laura and
That's
Mary
right.
were very excited about their peppermint sticks in their stockings. Let's talk about St. Nick. When did Santa start showing up for children to climb up on his lap and whisper wishes?
Yeah, he started coming up during the Victorian days mm-hmm. too. And that was, again, with the Germans coming around and so that was a big deal back then and exciting for the children.
From what I've heard, and I correct in this, that our popular image of Santa kind of mm-hmm. came out of Coca-Cola ads?
Yeah, yeah.
In the 20s?
Yeah, if you look at the early Christmas cards or you look at early advertisements, he's kind of a scary-looking guy in a way. Mm-hmm. He's much more of a woods person and much, much more European-looking.
Thinner.
And thinner, exactly. If you look at the old Swiss or German images of Santa Claus. He's much more of a normal-looking person, but with a big beard in a way. But a woodsman, he'll have a hooded coat on or something like that.
Okay.
But he's not a big, bushy, hefty fellow with a red nose and all that kind of stuff.
So I suspect between the night before Christmas mm-hmm. with Clement Moore's description
yeah.
of his, his
right.
belly
yeah.
shook like a bowl
right.
full of jelly, that
that's
got
right.
him a little fuzzier and warmer.
Yeah, that's right. The play Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker or
sure.
stuff like that
sure.
added to the image of Christmas a lot.
Now, we talk today and grumble about retailers pushing the Christmas season on us to boost mm-hmm. sales, but this is nothing really new, is it?
No, that's been going on for long.
As long as there have been retailers.
As long as there are people, and Christmas and retailers, they've been doing the same thing. But I will say people seemed like there was more concern for, say, the counter people, the workers in the stores. They would say there was articles almost every year, make sure to shop early so the counter people don't have to work 12-hour days at the counters. They worked long hours.
Mm.
And there were lines of people to get in the store. They could barely control the crowds downtown. You had to wait your turn to get in. The building was so crowded.
Wow.
Yeah, right. But they had great displays. And you'll see pictures of the old days, and you see people lined up all along the sidewalk waiting to get in the store or waiting to get a bus and that kind of thing.
And I can remember very much chestnuts being roasted, vendors right on Woodward selling those.
Yeah, that's
I know
right.
it's memory lane here, but why not at
I
Christmas
know,
time?
Who knows?
And there was still concern, was there not, for the less fortunate?
There was. There was a lot. That was a big part of Christmas from the very earliest days. I found in 1847 a request in the Detroit Free Press for people to, it says here, to save a turkey, pig, or some other such thing to provide a Merry Christmas for those who otherwise would return to their beds hungry and starving. That's That's a long time ago.
That was.
Yeah.
That was.
And they also they gave Christmas dinners to everybody. I mean, they provided them to prisoners. They provided little gifts for people in the poorhouse. So everybody at that point in time seemed to get something special.
Very fun. Historian Bill Loomis. And if you care to prepare Christmas goose pie from 1828, Bill has kindly provided us with that and some other vintage Christmas recipes. And we have put them on our page for you. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on the stateside link. And you, too, can have Christmas goose pie. It sounds yummy. Bill, always a pleasure talking with you. And
thanks,
have a Merry Christmas.
Yeah, you too.
Coming up, we'll look back at the state's biggest political stories. Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta will join us to remind us of the good, the bad, and the ugly. That's next here on Stateside. As we come to a close for this year, we're taking a look back at the stories, the really big stories that made really big headlines in 2012. Earlier in the show, we looked back at the auto industry. Well, let's now turn to politics. For that, we bring in two people whom I think quite literally live and breathe politics, Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. They co-host It's Just Politics here on Michigan Radio. Welcome, you two.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, I think we have to start with the most recent big story, quack, quack, and that would be lame duck.
make the jokes here.
I think you can't not start this without talking about lame duck. It was an insane couple of weeks for lawmakers, for the people that watched the media. And it will be really interesting to watch in the new year all of the laws that were passed. We're still waiting for Governor Snyder to decide whether to sign or veto them. But, I mean, the citizens of Michigan have a lot to look forward to, too, in the new year as we sort through what, Rick, more than 280 laws passed in those 3 weeks?
Not a record, but perhaps nearly a record, and certainly a lot. This is probably the most consequential December since the mid-1990s, and Proposal A just kind of upended the school funding system.
Absolutely.
And as evidence of that, look at all the things that got shoved to the back burner in terms of people's attention. The Blue Cross overhaul, even the new emergency manager law.
Yeah.
We had bills dealing with abortion, local property taxes, and even gun control was one of those pieces of legislation that was getting secondary attention compared to right to work until that horrible event in Connecticut on Friday, one day after the legislature adopted some new concealed weapons standards that would allow them in, among other places, schools and daycares.
And all of this, of course, possible because the GOP had that nice, juicy majority in both the State House and Senate.
Right. One of the reasons why we saw so much activity in this lame duck session is because while the Senate majorities will remain the same, House Republicans, they'll remain in the majority, but they'll have five fewer seats in that majority, which means that they've got fewer lawmakers who can take a walk on controversial votes.
We certainly cannot talk about lame duck without really addressing the biggest story coming out of it, which, of course, is right to work, Zoe.
Yeah, I mean, just the historic nature, of this policy. I mean, Michigan of all states, 24th state to become right to work, second in the Midwest after Indiana. Of course, we just saw thousands and thousands of protesters descend onto the Capitol. And then there's the political nature of it, that for months, years, really, since Governor Snyder took office, saying that right to work was not on his agenda. And then within a really short time during lame duck, it went from it's on the agenda to a week later him signing it.
So, Rick, what was the politicking behind all of that?
Well, what happened was really, you know, the governor said on Detroit Public Television that this was a failure of relationships, that clearly, you know, he and Republicans in the legislature had failed to establish the kind of dialogue he wanted with unions in order to keep it from coming to this juncture. The governor would have liked to have seen Proposal 2, the bargaining rights ballot proposal, not go on the ballot, and the unions sort of thumbed their noses at him over that. And, you know, what you saw, especially a lot of it was from West Michigan, a lot of conservatives, Dick DeVos among them, who saw the rejection of Proposal 2 as their opening, their opportunity, while the legislature still had these commanding Republican majorities, to come in and make Michigan a right-to-work state and really force that decision upon the governor.
You have to wonder what not on my agenda really does mean this day. Do you think that this is really
hurtful? I don't think we'll be hearing a whole lot of that in the future.
Then not on my agenda. Do you think this has hurt One Tough Nerd's credibility?
Well, I think that's the issue now. I mean, it was the same with the helmet law repeal. It's fine to say it's not on your agenda. For a while, I think it made people believe then that for some reason that would mean he would veto if it did come to his desk. Right. And what we're realizing is that's not necessarily what it means. I don't know if it hurts his
How much does it matter if it's not on your agenda?
Right. I don't know if it hurts the credibility, but I think it makes people a little more wary when he says that doesn't mean it's not going to happen.
And, you know, I think it does perhaps hurt the governor is, at least in terms of how he's tried to position himself, is he tried to present himself as an apolitical moderate. And so he's kind of gone from that, you know, apolitical centrist to a conservative Republican governor. And we're going to now see him lumped in with Scott Walker in Wisconsin, John Kasich in Ohio. Those were the sorts of governors, you know, real anti-union firebrands. And he's now been lumped in with them. And that's never a place that he wanted to be.
Who would both of you say is the most powerful person in Lansing right now?
Jace Bolger.
Hey.
I mean, it's interesting. You would sort of think, right, that of course it should be, or just from reading our civics books in eighth grade, that it's the executive branch, it's the governor or the president. But that has just not been the case. It is totally, I think, and it's not
the
just
House
Rick
Speaker.
And I saying this, it is Republican House Speaker Jace Bolger.
And he was on some mighty thin ice earlier in the year, wasn't he?
Oh, yes.
Oh, he came within a few hundred votes of losing his normally reliable, safe Republican seat, in large part because of how House Republicans mismanaged a couple of issues, particularly the Roy Schmidt party switch, which basically turned into an election rigging scheme. And it really, really damaged his credibility. And you would think that, you know, the speaker would have come back to Lansing a little chastened after that experience. And instead, he's running the table.
And then talk about a little, we can't let the year go by without talking about Vaginagate.
So. Well, and I think we bring that up now because of Jace Bolger. Democratic female lawmakers over the summer trying to speak out against a measure having to do with abortion.
That was ultimately adopted by the legislature,
indeed,
although in
during
a somewhat
lame
amended form.
Yeah, and they were told they couldn't speak on the chamber floor after they used the word vagina.
One of them did.
Yeah.
One of them used vagina. One of them said vasectomy.
Right, right. I mean, I don't think anyone thought that word would get so much attention, not just here in Michigan, national attention.
Well, usually before you'd say something like that, we'd at least take like a long pause and think about it, and now we just toss it out.
That's true.
Yeah.
All of that happened over the summer, but we had another very odd summertime story. Former Congressman Thaddeus McCotter
gets the weirdest story of the year title. Congressman McCotter, he didn't have enough signatures, apparently, to get on the August primary ballot. So some members in his staff, now he says he didn't know they were doing this. He has said it was, you know, he was not aware. They cut and pasted out of photocopies signatures, something like.
And it looks like they may have even done this in
previous elections.
This wasn't the first time.
But the comedy gods have brought you a new gift.
Carrie Bentivoglio.
Teacher, reindeer farmer, Santa helper.
Santa.
Yeah.
So he is, come January, will be the congressman that is replacing Thad McCotter.
Well, let's keep this on the election front. Take us back to February. We're in the middle of the Republican primary, and suddenly America's attention is focused on Michigan, coming out of the Iowa caucus and the primaries in New Hampshire and Florida. So it looked like the race was between former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum and former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. And it seemed like Michigan should have been a pretty easy state for the Bloomfield Hills raised Romney. But certainly not the case, was it, Zoe?
No, totally not the case. I mean, for a couple of weeks, I have to admit, Rick and I were just thrilled. We had so much fun with this. Michigan was in the spotlight. Mm-hmm. National media was here. Michigan really, really mattered.
Yeah.
I mean, Santorum's numbers were looking good. Romney was having a hard time in the campaign, which we saw throughout the year with Romney. He would just sort of have these down spells where he would just put his foot in his mouth. Mm. You know, like you said, Cindy, it was sort of thought that Romney would come into Michigan. He would do fine because of the, you know, so-called native son status, his father being former governor of Michigan, George Romney. But it was a super
super, super tight race.
And you know, the Republican establishment here put so much effort into trying to make it so that it would be a pretty easy Romney win, that it was supposed to show that not only could, you know, he win the state in the primary, but he could also then turn around and win it in November, which would be a huge upending of how presidential elections have worked for decades, that Michigan has gone for Democrats. Instead, it was a tight race, and Republicans even had to change the rules at the last minute to avoid a tie with Rick Santorum.
Mm.
There was real, you know, political cost to switching over one delegate so that Mitt Romney could technically claim a win rather than a tie.
One delegate that in the end just didn't even really matter much.
Yes, because let's talk about Election Day on November 6th.
Well, I mean, I think the oddest thing is we're talking about is that November 6th didn't seem to be that big of a deal in terms of the status quo here in Michigan. There was so much money from different political action groups, from candidates. And yet, you know, the morning after November 6th, come November 7th, Michigan politics hadn't changed much. We stayed a blue state.
Meet the old boss.
Same as the new boss.
No. I mean, stayed a blue state in terms of, you know, we went for Obama. We went for Senator Debbie Stabenow. Republicans kept the state house. Again, like we talked about, lost 5 seats, went to the Democrats. But really, the status quo remained the same after so much time and attention and money being spent.
I mean, certainly the election was very consequential for the lame duck session of the legislature. But beyond that, you know, looking ahead to the coming session, yeah, the same people are in charge.
But the real story had to have been, in Michigan at least, all of those ballot proposals.
Right. It wasn't so much the candidates that made the headlines from the November election in Michigan, but instead all of the ballot proposals. I mean, I think Rick and I...
Ballot-palooza.
Right. We did a story about that. 5 proposals, 1 referendum on the state's emergency manager law. All 5 proposals got shot down. Now, voters did, you know, vote to reject the state's super controversial emergency manager law, but everything else
went down. But I wonder how
down.
Much, and I wonder how much of the emergency manager law going down was just part of people voting no on everything because there was so much.
Well, as we kind of wrap up, let's end with a story that really made huge headlines all year long and will certainly be doing so in the new year. We talked about it, the state's emergency manager law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the few pieces of controversial legislation that was not rendered referendum proof.
Right. And by that, what Rick means is that if you pass a bill in the legislature that you don't want voters to be able to repeal, you put money into it, appropriations into it, you make it a budget
bill. We saw that in Right to Work.
Exactly. And so what that does is it doesn't allow voters to repeal it. That's what happened with the emergency manager law passed in 2011. There was not money in it. So it went through this process of finally being able to be repealed. Now, what Rick was mentioning is that now Republican lawmakers, and let's remember, Democrats have done this in the past, too. This is not just one party doing this, but Republican lawmakers.
But this has certainly been a supercharged effort to take just, you know, every controversial legislation. I think there are 2 or 3 bills in lame duck alone that were given appropriations to avoid having them challenged by referendum.
And these are appropriations to do things like print pamphlets to help voters become more aware of the issue. And then also interesting to note that appropriation, that money doesn't all have to be spent.
It's putting the appropriation in, not actually
spending
the money.
It.
So you could put in as much money as you want with, you know, an understanding that that's not how much is going to be spent on it. And, you know, you've dodged a ballot challenge.
Right. But obviously, Cindy, you can tell Rick and I can get sidetracked sometimes when we're talking politics. I believe the question was about the emergency manager law.
And
what
especially
we know,
looking ahead now, because we've got a
exactly.
new one.
Exactly. Voters in November, they said, we don't want this controversial law. Well, okay. So lawmakers said, fine, here's a new law and here's money in it so you can't repeal it. And I really think, Rick, I mean, that this is what we're going to be spending a lot of time on in the new year is looking at this new emergency manager law, particularly as we just see the finances in Detroit continue to be such a huge issue. The politics over, could the governor actually appoint an emergency manager? I mean, this
which
law
seems to be coming more and more inevitable.
Exactly.
And in fact, the governor said they're already deciding who might be that emergency manager.
This law, I think, come 2013, is really along, like we talked about, with gun control issues. I think the EM is going to be what we're all watching.
And if you want to look at how things might play out in 2014, look at the statewide races, especially the gubernatorial elections in Virginia and New Jersey, where I think a lot of the themes and tactics that will be tried in 2014 will be tested in those competitive states.
Yeah. And should we look into 2015, too, 2016, just for fun?
2020.
I think we're good. It was quite a year. Rick, Zoe, thank you so very, very much.
Thank you, Cindy.
It's fun.
And as I mentioned, Rick and Zoe probably spend a little too much time thinking about politics, but you can find the fruits of their mental labor online at MichiganRadio.org, or you can listen to them every Friday afternoon at 1:35 right here on Michigan Radio. The unspeakable tragedy of the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School, it's become a thunderbolt into the collective heart of America. Certainly, its impact on children is something that is extra powerful. Those 20 young victims at Sandy Hook could be your classmates or your brother or your sister. Like all of us in America and around the world, 11-year-old Noah Hudson Peralta was deeply affected by the terrible events last Friday in Connecticut. Noah is a sixth grader at Lance Cruz Middle School South in Clinton Township. He's come up with what he hopes will be a way for other kids to honor those 20 little boys and girls who died so violently, the Sandy Hook 20. Hi, Noah.
Hi.
So you were watching all the coverage. I'm sure you couldn't escape it, and talking all of this over about what happened at Sandy Hook with your dad. And what did you come up with as far as a way to help other kids remember these children?
Well, me and my dad were talking the last week, actually. We came up with Gifts 420, where every kid buys a gift and gives it to a kid in need in honor of the kids who died last week.
So it's Gifts 420, which is really perfect. Where'd you get that idea? Where did that come from? Everybody's watching things and feeling bad and not knowing what to do, and you actually came up with a really good idea.
I actually just thought of it by my own and just thought of Toys for Tots.
Well, it's really commendable that you've come up with this idea, and your dad has set up a website, giftsfor20.org. Can I talk to your dad for a minute?
Yep.
Hello?
Hi, Ryan.
Hi. Hi.
It's really great that you have a boy that doesn't just take in this terrible news, but says, what can we do to make something good out of this? How soon after the news hit about Sandy Hook did Noah express some kind of desire to do something?
We, you know, because of that day, you know, for everyone in the United States, I'm sure, and everybody around the world, is a rough day for everyone. And I just kind of, I told him, I said, let's go get out of the house. Let's go do some Christmas shopping. And I don't know if you know, but I'm disabled. I have no arms, no legs. So thankfully, I have a very helpful family and son. So, you know, when I go shopping, I need someone to go with me. So Noah went with me, and we were just driving in the car, and he brought it up. He said, Dad, I don't know what, but we should do something. And I said, well, think of something. Think of something that you'd want to do. And about 20, 30 minutes later, he said, what if we get kids to donate presents to other needy kids in honor of these kids that passed away? I don't cry too much, but, I mean, it was like hearing my son say something you know, it was just such a selfless statement. So, I mean, for 11 years old, he really amazed me.
That's our local hero, Noah Hudson Peralta, and his proud dad, Ryan, both of them hoping children all over Michigan will donate a new unwrapped toy this Saturday to the U.S. Marine Corps Toys for Tots program, all in honor of the 20 children who were lost to us last Friday at Sandy Hook Elementary School. You can learn more at Noah's website, giftsfor20.org, and that's the number 20, giftsfor20.org. And we put a link on our website at michiganradio.org. And with this show, we wrap up Stateside for 2012. We will rejoin you on January 2nd. It has been such a joy for all of us to bring you this show and to talk with you and to get to know you. And I'm already looking forward to many more conversations in the new year. This is Stateside, a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty, and from all of us at Stateside, we wish you the happiest of holidays and a happy, healthy new year.